You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. And we are here in our solar-powered radio station.
Going strong.
In the sunny Midwest. In the sunny, hot, hot Midwest.
But you know, it's not quite as bad today. It doesn't go when you go outside.
That is true. Mm-hmm. And you are listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilburn.
Good afternoon, everyone.
So you're staying in from the heat.
Trying to.
So that must mean you have time to read.
Yes, well, yes. I've read this book, and then for today, and then for next week's as well. And it's going to be very interesting, and I'm looking forward to both of these interviews.
Right. Well, we'll just give you a little preview of next week. We have Zoe Gadarmani, who is an Iranian author that I met in California. And her book, Sky of Red Poppies, is the lead book in the One San Diego kind of book club contest.
Oh.
So we'll find out more about that next week.
Uh-huh.
And now, let's introduce today's guest.
Okay, well, we have Michael Roseman.
Roseman.
And he's a psychologist and a farmer whose life's work involves improving the behavioral health care of the agricultural population. And he seeks to advance regional and global food production policy, which enhances the behavioral and economic welfare of food producers, maintains stewardship of the land and other resources used in food production, and protects the safety of food for consumers, which, of course, is extremely important. In the era of increasing tension due to bioterrorist threats and shifts in the agribusiness climate, he is a voice for the agricultural population. The New York Times said this about him: a fourth-generation farmer, as well as a clinical psychologist, he speaks the language of men and women on the verge of losing their place on the land.
And Michael's book is titled
Excellent Joy.
Welcome to Writers' Voices, Mike.
Thank you.
So let's start out with, what is Excellent Joy?
Well, Excellent Joy, Fishing, Farming, Hunting, and Psychology, is a collection of anecdotes that basically are events that occurred in my life over the past 30-some years or so. They are more meaningful, or made more meaningful, because often they're just little nuances, but they have a lot of significance, because I think they helped not only shape me, but hopefully they have a message for people who read the book. I've enjoyed writing these series of stories, and it's my first book that I have undertaken entirely by myself.
And when is it being released, or has it already been?
It has been released by Ice Cube Press in June, and it is available at Ice Cube Press. Is it all right if I mention the website?
Yes, definitely.
Oh, yes.
www.icecubepress.com. Ice Cube Press is all one word. You can also find information about the book on Facebook under Excellent Joy, Fishing, Farming, Hunting, and Psychology.
Okay, tell us, I was most interested to read how you came up with Excellent Joy, or how it was presented to you. I want you to tell us that story.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to do that. The name actually comes from my deceased brother. I have a brother who was 8 years younger than me, who passed away 3 years ago. His name was Larry. Larry was born with Down syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
He's the youngest of four boys in the family. Because of his Down syndrome, he had a somewhat limited vocabulary, but Larry took enormous pleasure in many of the simple things of life. For example, each Christmas, the high school band would have a Christmas concert, and at the end, the concert director would ask all the children and anyone else who wished to come forth and to help direct the band in a medley of Christmas songs. Larry always joined the children as they went in front of the stage. And he would stand at the podium, and with his baton, he would tap the podium, and everybody would begin. And over the years, Larry developed a reputation within the community as someone who had a deep love of music and who took great pleasure in helping to direct the Christmas concert.
Mm-hmm.
At the end, Larry would be so delighted that in his limited vocabulary, he often would say, "Excellent Joy." And he would do that whenever he felt a great sense of accomplishment or joy in events. Larry was a true inspiration for this book because even though he led a simple life with many disabilities, he found a way to stay focused and to lead a life that I think was a wonderful example for many of us who lead much more complicated lives with lots of baggage and uncertainties and, you know, variations in our motives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a beautiful story, and I, Excellent Joy is, it says it all, doesn't it?
It doesn't sound like a limited vocabulary.
No,
does
it doesn't.
Well, Larry had maybe about 200 words in his vocabulary, but he could communicate very clearly.
Wow.
And always joined us in the family events until at the very end when his health deteriorated. But
right.
I tell you, he's been an inspiration for so many of us because he never complained. He was able to endure enormous pain, and he made it his mission to make people feel good and welcome wherever he went. So he was outgoing and wonderfully social.
Well, we need a lot more people like that, don't we? That are.
Yep.
Now, it sounds from your book that you get a lot of excellent joy from one particular activity.
Yes.
Well, I actually get it from many.
I'm sure you do, but there.
I think
there's
you're hinting that maybe fishing might be up there towards.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I do enjoy fly fishing a great deal, but what I have found is that, you know, the attitude we take toward whatever we're involved in has a lot to do with whether it is joyful or whether it becomes perhaps. Just a selfish act or exploitative or something like that. But fishing clearly is a wonderful pursuit for me. It's a mind clearer. It is a centering kind of activity. But the title says fishing, farming, hunting, and psychology. Those are all sources of enormous joy and inspiration for me and have been, and that's what the stories are about, fishing events and hunting episodes with other people, especially my son, sometimes with my father-in-law. And some of the time we accomplished something, such as being able to land a few fish, but there were many times that we didn't necessarily succeed terribly well, but you know, we thoroughly enjoyed the occasions of being outdoors and developing a rapport among ourselves and with the surrounding nature.
Well, Mike, where do you live now?
I live near Harlan, Iowa, in the western part of the state, about 100 miles west of Des Moines. We live on a family farm.
Now, Iowa isn't known for fly fishing, necessarily.
It's not, and that's kind of nice. It is perhaps a leading way to capture the fish that are in Iowa's farm ponds. Nothing like a nicely chosen fly on a fly rod works so well to capture smallmouth, bass of all types, largemouth mainly, but crappie and bluegills, and boy, what wonderful eating fish they are.
So there's maybe the secret will be out now that you've written this book about fly fishing and people realize, oh, it's not just western streams that you can go fly fishing or western rivers.
Fly fishing is really diversified. It's not only after trout or salmon or even ocean-going fish. I think it's a well-kept sort of a trade. It's not meant to be a secret, but it clearly is a way of fishing that not everyone pursues, but I think it's very rewarding because I tie my own flies and we get right in the water. I fish out of a float tube. That's an inner tube with a harness in it, and I wear waders and put fins on my feet, and then I paddle around out in the river or the lake and cast my flies as I move around the body of water.
So you're sitting in the inner tube with your feet dangling in the water, and that's how you move around?
That's right. I paddle myself with my feet because the harness, you know, holds me up, but the body's natural buoyancy, along with the support from the float tube, keeps maybe the upper third of our body out of the water. And of course, I sometimes have to have a cigar in my mouth to keep the mosquitoes away.
Of course. Now that,
you can get around out there easily. You can hold your position if the wind is blowing around, and yet at the same time have our hands free so that we can cast the rod and collect the fish in a net or whatever we need to do.
It doesn't scare the fish that your feet are down there dangling around,
paddling.
I imagine I've scared quite a few fish over the
years. But when you're fly fishing, you're actually fishing quite a
ways from yourself. Yes,
yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, you're fishing anywhere from 30 to 50 feet. I like to cast the fly at least 50 feet, sometimes farther. And
yeah,
you know, it's probably as surreptitious as fishing from a canoe or maybe from a John boat, and I've done that method of fishing a lot too, from a canoe, I should say. The fish don't see me from that distance, and the only things I have to be concerned about are the turtles that sometimes try to capture or take the fish away that I have in my net. There are big snapping turtles that like to compete for the fish as well.
Oh, yeah.
I keep my eyes open for them and just have a good time out there.
Well, you had one, I don't know if it was close call or not, but when you were ice fishing and you got to, the ice was too thin and you fell through, that must have been us. But you kept on going. I mean, you were fishing the rest of the whole day.
Well, I've had a number of harrowing experiences, either fishing or hunting, and yes, I did fall through, and this was it was the day that Krista McAuliffe was killed in the exploration, I think it was the spaceship was going up to the module.
The Challenger?
All of people that were in the Voyage, I think it was the Voyager, the aircraft exploded as it left the launch pad from Cape Kennedy in Florida.
It was Challenger.
On that particular day, three other farmers and I went fishing. It was in February, if I recall correctly. And as we got out on the pond, we didn't catch any fish initially. So one of the farmers, who was also my hired hand, and I walked into the upper reaches of the farm pond, maybe a quarter mile away. The ice was thinner, but I noticed it too late. The ice was thinner because water was flowing in the channel under the ice, and as the water entered the pond, it was a little warmer than in the lower reaches of the pond. That warmer water melted the ice, and lo and behold, it broke under me, and I went completely under. As I went under, I had an auger that we used to drill holes in the ice in one hand, and I kept that above the ice, and I used that as a brace to hold myself above the ice when I popped back up.
Mm.
And then I maneuvered my way to a tree that was angling at about a 45-degree angle out of the water, And with my other hand, I grabbed a hold of the trunk, and I worked my way up and was able to crawl up the trunk high enough that I swung myself with my one arm and landed about 10 feet away, and the water there was only about a foot and a half deep, so I didn't worry about...
You weren't going to drown.
So at that point, my accompanying hired hand and I, we decided, well, maybe we better go back to the truck. So we started back to the truck, and the other two friends were catching fish, one after another, and having a good time. Meanwhile, the wind was about, the wind chill was probably 20 below, and the temperature was about zero.
Oh my gosh.
And the outside of my clothes, which were completely wet,
y'all
froze. Borrowed Dan's hat, he gave it to me, my stocking cap, I put it on, and by the time we got to our friends who were catching all the fish, the outside of my clothes was froze up, and Dan says, don't you think we better go to the truck and warm up? And I said, what for? I'm nice and warm inside from walking all this distance and from the excitement. And for the next hour, we all four fished. Even though my clothes were wet on the inside, they were frozen on the outside, and the wind couldn't penetrate them, and we caught probably 3 buckets of fish.
And did you catch a cold?
No, I didn't.
That's
not
a death.
That time, but I've probably caught a few colds over the years in various misadventures.
Well, the interesting thing is, well, not interesting, I mean, you were used to precarious situations. Being a farmer, I know. And
well, some of them are my own making.
Yeah, I know. But you kept your head, you didn't panic, and so that was, you know, it was your salvation there.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Mike Roseman, the author of Excellent Joy, Fishing, Farming, Hunting, and Psychology. So let's talk a little bit about the psychology aspect. What is agri-wellness, and what is your connection with that?
Well, AgriWellness is a nonprofit corporation that provides administrative supports to farm crisis telephone hotlines and a whole range of services designed to meet the needs of agricultural producers throughout the upper Midwest. But we've really expanded beyond the Midwest to all of the country, and now we're starting to have a presence outside of the U.S. as well. The work that I'm engaged in is to understand the unique presenting characteristics of farm and ranch people and farm workers, because farm people are different in their culture, in the way they handle work, the way they approach life. I am trying to understand that, as are many other people, and to now develop a textbook and curriculum to train mental health or behavioral health care professionals, but also physicians, nurses, counselors of all types to work more effectively with the farm population. So AgriWellness is aimed at helping agricultural people obtain behavioral health treatments when necessary to deal with the stresses that accompany agricultural production, and to understand how to manage our own behaviors. That's why we have the term agri-wellness, because it places the control more in the hands of the person who is seeking assistance. Traditional mental health treatments, like psychiatric treatments, often involve seeing a psychiatrist or someone who prescribes medications. The control of that rests with the psychiatrist. Yes, the patient takes the medication, but the psychiatrist is more responsible for the outcome by managing the medications. In a similar way, many counselors seek to help people understand why they are depressed and to do something about it by maybe working through the issues, relationship problems, or whatever that may be contributing to depression. but the outcome again rests largely with the counselor whose expertise is necessary to help. I don't view myself so much as the person responsible for the outcome as I feel like I am a coach, an educator, someone who helps people understand what they are doing that may be making things worse and to also make sense of things. So I help people understand our own behaviors, and that's why I'm working on a textbook now. But all of the work of agri-wellness has been to make behavioral health more acceptable, just more understandable, and more available to people who, by their own nature, tend to be reluctant to seek help because...
Or even to admit there's a problem.
Yep. Agricultural people are sturdy people who are who keep things to themselves and tough it out, even when it would be better off to reach out for assistance.
Right.
So there's a number of stories in the book that are about some of the founding days of agricultural behavioral health and some of the events that I've encountered as I've been working along with others to make some sense of this whole arena.
Well, you say in one section that you realized you're a small part of a larger system and that your role is to contribute to the good of the whole. And if everybody contributes, everyone benefits. And so in today's world, we tend to set ourselves apart into factions, and this is the problem, as I see it.
Yeah, our culture seems to be going in the opposite direction to some extent, where it's me first and you know, doesn't matter what happens to anyone else. And your book is really a speaking out for I think a growing movement of no, that's not what it's about. If getting ahead at the expense of others, you're not really getting ahead.
I agree with you, and thank you for making those connections, because I think that's where the meaning comes in our lives, is not through our personal accomplishments, but through the joys we get from helping others to make something of their lives. And again, I have to go back to Larry, but also to some of my colleagues, to my family. I learned a lot of lessons from the people I've worked with in a counseling role, but also I learned a lot from my family, my children, my wife, and I've written a lot about my father-in-law in this book. He's the man who taught me how to fly fish and in many ways modeled this simple pursuit of life without having to have all the trappings and lots of money. You know, working for money is becomes an empty thing. I so much like the foreword that Dr. Fred Kirschenman of Iowa State University's Leopold Center wrote to the book Excellent Joy. In it, in the foreword, he mentioned that we are constantly involved in the pursuit of worldly things. I'll just have to pull that out here and read it for just a second.
Okay, that's a good plan. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Mike Roseman, author of Excellent Joy, Fishing, Farming, Hunting, and Psychology. He's going to read a passage from the foreword of this book.
Thank you. This foreword is by Dr. Fred Kirschenman, the former director of the Leopold Center at Iowa State University, and now still is in many ways kind of the, I guess I could say, the spiritual resource for that and many other programs that impact agriculture. But Dr. Kirschenman says, the evolution of the gospel of consumption led us to at least two unintended consequences. First, the gospel of consumption led us to conclude that the only way we can have a healthy economy is through unlimited growth, a concept that Herman Daly reminds us is now so fixed in our society that any effort to challenge it is one of our culture's great anathemas.
Yeah.
Furthermore, the unintended consequence of this non-negotiable principle in our society is the ruination of our ecological capital, a fact that now puts the lives of our children and grandchildren in jeopardy. A second unintended consequence of the gospel of consumption is that it has actually deteriorated rather than improved our well-being. While we may still try to convince ourselves that more material wealth and consumption improves our well-being, all the evidence suggests the opposite. In his enlightening study, The High Price of Materialism, the psychologist Tim Kaser points out that as wealth has increased, our well-being has actually decreased. The results of the research suggested a rather startling conclusion that the American dream has a dark side, and the pursuit of wealth and possessions might actually be undermining our well-being. Dr. Kaser concludes that when materialistic values dominate our society, we move farther and farther from what makes us civilized. Despite these conclusions that are even confirmed by extensive research, we continue to convince ourselves that our only path to happiness is one of developing the capacity to acquire as much material wealth as possible. Boy, those are good words.
Yes, they are.
That's really, really something to think about. And, you know, of course, part of the problem is that, an insufficient amount of wealth is really difficult to deal with. I mean, if you're really struggling financially, it can be very devastating. And so it's hard not to realize that beyond a certain point, additional wealth doesn't help. But when it's the difference between being able to feed your kids and not, the additional wealth really is does add to your well-being. You know.
There is a sense in which wealth or anything materialistic, whether it's clothes or, you know, good looks or possessions, they delude us into thinking that we have to have more and that our happiness depends on having more and more.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, true happiness doesn't come from having more external possessions. True happiness comes from internal satisfaction. And that internal satisfaction comes from a sense of giving and contributing to others' well-being and improvement. It comes from a deep spiritual commitment, an enrichment, a joy in our relationship with a higher power. I think those are the things that give us true meaning. If we work to obtain money and wealth and possessions, our lives become empty. Mm-hmm. But when we strive to make ourselves better people and to accept whatever is placed in our path ahead of us. If we can accept those things, we can turn even the worst of circumstances into an opportunity to make ourselves better people. There's a sense in which that's the message of this entire book, and Dr. Kirschenman captured it, so did my brother Larry, and I hope that I've inspired people through these little anecdotes to look deeper within themselves and to find meaning and joy through, you know, personal experiences of giving, whether it's through work or maybe through even things like getting close to nature, camping, hunting, fishing. Farming is certainly one of those prime opportunities to experience the joy that comes from producing essentials for life. Food and fiber, and increasingly renewable energy. So the book is aptly named, and from my brother Larry, as Excellent Joy, Fishing, Farming, Hunting, and Psychology.
I hate to see the disappearance of the individual family farm. I'm a native Iowan, and my grandparents were farmers, and I spent quite a bit of time with them. And so I just hate to see these mega farms taking over.
There are two types of agriculture that are developing in our country and in many other countries. One is a large commercial type of agriculture that relies heavily on technology, on building skills to produce one or two crops. That specialization is designed to produce a uniform product. Often it is exploitative kind of agriculture because it uses up the soil. It involves putting on the right amounts of fertilizer. It also involves using human labor, fuel, big machinery. And that style of agriculture produces a lot of product. The other style of agriculture is the more sustainable family farming type of agriculture. Often it's organic. This style of agriculture is working with the with nature itself rather than to control it, but to work with it so that we use natural pesticides such as other insects that can kill desired species that are harming our crops, where we rely on rotation of crops to produce a lot of the necessary fertilizers and on the use of manure from animals. These diversified farms often involve the production of many crops and many forms of livestock, cattle, chickens, swine, and the byproducts, that is manure and so forth, go back into the earth to recycle and to produce the next crop. That style of agriculture is not exploitative, but rather it is in harmony. Mm-hmm. It's the fastest growing style of agriculture in our country. The number of practitioners of family farming and organic products is growing about three times as fast as the style of agriculture that involves monoculture and the heavy reliance on technology.
Well, that's good news, because it seems like the last 50 years of the prior century, it was all going in the other direction. And
it's been the overall amount of goods being produced by far and away is greater from what is now called conventional agriculture, but it's anything but conventional.
Right, right.
It's industrialized agriculture.
That's a better word for it.
Yep. Yeah. Industrialized agriculture is producing more and more product, but the number of farms that are the sustainable organic type of production unit are growing much faster. And there is, I think, a greater likelihood that through sustainable practices, we will have the resources necessary for future generations. It's not exploitative. It is nourishing. It's living with the conditions that surround us.
And we're fortunate here in Fairfield that you can pretty much meet all of your food needs from local sustainable agriculture.
You have wonderful organic farmers and, let's say, producers of crops and vegetables for farmer markets in your area, and in many ways you are a beacon of light among agricultural producers.
And of course Radiance Dairy is really a leader in the dairy industry. Francis Tickey was, you know, amazingly was the Democratic candidate for Secretary of Agriculture for the state of Iowa. If he had succeeded in winning, I think that would have sent a really powerful message across the whole country.
And well, it is necessary that both styles of agriculture dialogue together because both do contribute certain types of outcomes that are necessary. We need a lot of food products, a lot of products that contribute the fiber and the renewable fuel, but at the same time we also need the new knowledge that is being gained from sustainable techniques so that they are not dismissed but rather incorporated,
right?
And so that we have a unified, eclectic approach to agriculture.
Well, Mike, we've gotten a little bit off topic here, so let's get back to the writing a little bit. How long did you actually work on this book?
Well, I first began working on it in a dedicated fashion about 4 years ago. At that time, I had written several short stories which were published in magazines, and another one came out in a book fairly recently. And some people said, you need to write more and tell the stories that you tell us when we're conversing. I began to put them down. I didn't know very much about writing in a creative vein. When I went to graduate school, the creative approach to writing and expressing myself was kind of beaten out of me because I had to write scientifically, had to use precise terms, mm-hmm. and I've written many, many journal articles and have been an editor of scholarly journals and that kind of thing, but I had kind of laid aside the creative part until I guess the first blooming of it occurred in the early 1990s when my sister-in-law gave everybody in the family a task for Christmas. She said, bring an anecdote that you have written that tells what is your favorite Christmas and why. Hmm. So I wrote a story that ended up in Excellent Joy, and it's called The Meaning of Christmas. I set it aside for many years until about 4 years ago, and then I began to refine it. I first approached Dan O'Brien, the author of Buffalo for the Brokenhearted. Dan is an author in South Dakota. He's won practically every prize except the Pulitzer. And I asked Dan for some help. He read my stories, and he said, Mike, get them out of third person. Put them in first person.
Mm.
Write from your experience. So I did that, and I began to write with more passion, and I think with more clarity. So I owe a lot of to Dan and perhaps to other people who read the stories and commented on them and helped me to put them into some sense.
Were you ever part of a writer's group?
I did not. I don't belong to a writer's group.
Now, what I'm really wondering is, these stories take place over, you know, quite a few years, and some of them quite a few years ago, and yet you have incredible details, particularly the fishing ones, about, you know, the size and the look and the quantity and the behavior of specific fish.
He's a fisherman.
Did you actually remember all these details, or did you keep them in a journal somewhere, or?
Oh, I remember them.
I knew it. I knew it.
Sorry, I'm losing my voice here just a little bit. But if I fade out, you'll have to take over.
Okay, right. Well, you could. We can pause and you can get a drink of water. That would probably help.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, your grandparents were fishermen. You know,
I know that. You remember that picture I drew of Grandma fishing in a boat when I was like 4 years old?
Yeah, I do. We went to Lake Cabtogama in Minnesota every summer. I grew up on a boat.
Oh, I thought it was Clear Lake.
Well, that was later.
That was
early
later.
On.
Okay.
It was Lake Cabtogama, and that's way up there, way up there, almost to Canada, and lots of fish. We ate fish three times a day. That's all we ate was fish. But I still like trout. I mean, it's, you know.
Now, did you ever fly fish?
No, I didn't. But I love to see. I love to watch somebody do that. It's a real art.
Yeah.
Tremendously.
Yeah, one of my favorite stories in here when, you know, we're talking about that there isn't a whole lot of fly fishermen in the Midwest. It's kind of a a secret almost. And there's one story in here where Mike happens upon a meeting of a chapter of Trout Unlimited and is invited to fish with them. Mike, are you back yet?
I'm sort of back.
Okay.
Thank you for pinch hitting very effectively.
So I love that story. It seemed like perhaps not all fly fishermen are equal.
Oh, well, it no.
There are those who think that fly fishing is a purist art and activity, and there are the aficionados who spend a lot of money on expensive rods, including bamboo rods, and that's a wonderful pursuit. But you don't have to have a lot of trappings to be a successful fly fisherman.
No, it's in that arm, isn't it?
a fairly simple, inexpensive fiberglass or boron rod, and you can tie your own flies using materials that are readily available, feathers and fur from squirrels and deer, and as I indicated in the book, mink tails and so forth. But that particular story also was about a couple of flies that I gave. Well, I tied both of them, and as it turned out, through a little bit of luck, I did end up catching a few more fish than some of the little more expensive equipment. I'll let the rest go until people read the story. Now they have to read the story.
Really? Yeah, really.
Right, exactly.
It was pretty funny.
Now, how a lot of the stories also you write about your kids as children, and how now that they're grown up, how do they feel about you writing about them?
Well, you know, I've never asked them, and I had the opportunity to hear just this weekend because my son and his wife had their wedding reception out at our farm, and they were there, and then my daughter and her husband were there too, and somehow we were so busy with all of the reception activities we didn't talk about it. But I think that from the way they behave toward me, they're proud of the book. John and I are very close, and became close through our mutual fishing and hunting activities. Mm-hmm. It was a great joy when John asked me to be his best man at his wedding.
Oh, I should say.
How much better does it get?
It doesn't get any better than that. You bet.
She's in a health profession like her mother and me both. Mm-hmm. She goes at life a little differently. But I think she is very happy to see that here is something that not only brought meaning to my life, but now is apparently moving other people to think and to experience and to find joy in their own lives, and perhaps to explore some facets that they haven't adequately pursued, including fishing. So I think my children are very pleased with it, and I don't think they mind what I have written about them, because it's honest and it's not disparaging. It's just honest, and it gets at the relationships that we have formed and continue to work on.
You know, those of us who know what pleasures you can have from being out of doors, I feel sorry for anybody who's never experienced it. Even I like to think of a snowfall, a soft snowfall, and just, you know, I love to stand. Love to stand out in it, and think of Robert Frost's poems, and, you know, stopping by woods on a snowy evening. It's just, I don't know, it's just one of those. And I a beautiful sunrise, a sunset, there's just nothing compared to that.
And whenever I hear that poem, I think of you.
Do you?
Yes, yeah. Because you put that to music. You put that poem
yes,
to music.
Yes, I did. Yeah, that's right.
Years ago. Well, Mike, why do you have another part of what you wrote that you'd like to read to us?
Oh, I could.
Before we run out of time.
Okay. I believe if that's the case, I will begin reading just a little bit from the very last chapter. It's called The Behavior of Farm People. Mm. In some ways, this maybe should have been the first chapter, but sometimes it's best to have what shall be last can be first, and vice versa.
Uh-huh.
So here goes. As the second semester of college resumed at the University of Virginia, I was a teacher there, following Christmas break in mid-January 1979, I announced to my dozen or so graduate students and research assistants that I planned to resign from the psychology department faculty at the end of the semester to move to a family farm in western Iowa and to initiate a clinical psychology practice there. Several snickers arose, followed by muffled laughter and then stiff silence. A third-year graduate student, whose master's thesis I was supervising, asked, "Why are you leaving the University of Virginia to work with farmers?" I said, somebody has to take care of the mental health of farm people. I answered that, but the words didn't seem like they were mine. A deep inner force I couldn't explain seemed to be taking charge of my speaking. For the next several minutes, I found myself proclaiming that family farmers in the United States are an endangered species and a national treasure to be preserved. The students, like so many people, had come to take food for granted and had lost connections with the sources of their nourishment. I felt deep inner urges to defend agriculture and the people who work the land. I was exhilarated, resolute, and excited to be embarking on an adventure with a course as yet unknown. 20 weeks later, I was sitting on a tractor seat and planting corn with my father clinging to the fender on my left side. "Keep an eye on how the planter wants to slide down the hillside so your rows aren't as straight as they could be," Dad cautioned. "I'll make another round or two with you, but then you're on your own," he chippered and smiled with a look of pride in his eyes. I was the second son in the family to come back to the farm. Dad and Mom had not counted on us returning to farm. They figured Marilyn and I would continue as nursing and psychology professors, and our children, Shelby and John, would grow up on our 3 acres in Virginia, near where Meriwether Lewis family made their home. They withheld judgment when we announced our intentions during our Christmas visit, but commented positively how much thought we had given over the past 5 years to raising our family on a farm. Marilyn added the crowning observation that we had a huge garden on our acreage, and "Mike is always outside the house to check on the weather." She commented how she had wanted to marry a farm boy, but she didn't expect that someday she would live and work on a real Iowa farm. That's the beginning of it all.
So that's been quite a life's journey for you then.
Journey is a good word. Yeah. And what wonderful people I've had on the journey with me.
As you were writing these stories, did you learn new lessons from rethinking about them that maybe didn't occur to you at the time that the events occurred?
I would say that every time that I have revised stories and have thought about these things, I think it has perhaps changed the way I look at some things. Some of these stories I have modified 35 to 40 times. I truly enjoy looking at a draft and changing just a word or two there to find exactly the right feeling and the right meaning. I don't get tired of that. I do that with all my writing, and it becomes a source of fun. And in a sense, you're never really done.
Well, I was going to say, how do you know when it's when you're done, when it's ready to be published?
You have to draw an arbitrary point where you say,
enough.
I'm not going to make any more changes. I'm going to send it in, whether it's imperfect or not, because I could keep doing this for years. And
I know some people who do that, yes.
They can keep changing things all along. But, you know, we have to select a point where we say, I think it's enough that it will appeal to others. And we throw it out there and try to see if others find meaning in it as well. So, you know, and if you bomb, you can write more books. But I've already started on the second version, or a second edition of a similar set of stories. I don't know what I'll call it yet, but
More Excellent Joy?
I'm done.
How about More Excellent Joy?
Things like that. Yes.
Did you work with an editor at all during the writing process?
I did not.
Did not.
Except for, you know, a couple of letters that I exchanged with the writer, Dan O'Brien. But I met Steve Semkin a little over a year ago. Steve is the principal of Ice Cube Press, the publisher.
Right. He's been a guest on Writer's Voices.
Yeah. Steve and I met at the University of Iowa because I'm on the adjunct faculty there, and I was over there lecturing one day, and before I gave my lecture, well, I guess it was after, Steve and I met in a little restaurant, and I brought him the draft, and I had typed it all up, and in a big manila envelope, and I presented it to him. He didn't bother to open it. Tell me about yourself.
Mm.
And he proceeded to ask me, kind of some of the questions that you're asking. What do you want to accomplish? Tell me why you are here visiting with me today. Where are you going with things? It was more to sell myself than it was to sell my writings.
Mm-hmm.
Then he took the draft and studied it over the next several months, and about 6 months later, I was getting impatient, and I called him up and I said, Steve, have you had a chance to look at this yet? And he said, yeah, let's meet. And we agreed that, well, maybe there's some redeeming value in this, and he agreed to publish it. So that started a good friendship, and I've come to respect Steve a lot. He knows the craft, he knows the printing business, he knows the promotion business, and
right,
it's a lot of energy.
Now, did he do much editing?
Well, he helped me with a few things. He said, avoid the use of that. For example, we could say, she wished that she had a white dress.
Mm.
Instead of saying she wished that, you could simply say she wished she had a white dress.
Right.
That
right.
kind of thing. So there were little things that he taught me that I think improved the quality of the writing and made it flow a little bit better. It's been getting some really very nice reviews. I never expected it to get such good reviews, and they're just outstanding.
Oh, that's awesome.
Isn't it wonderful that a publishing company in the middle of Iowa can put out these wonderful books that might never get a chance with the great big publishers,
Yeah.
I think it's great.
So, Mike, what is the intended market for your book? Who would be interested in
Well, I hope the book appeals not just to hunters and fishers and maybe people involved in agriculture. I hope it appeals to people who are looking for peace in their lives, perhaps people who are looking for communion with nature. I hope it appeals to folks who like good literature, who enjoy hearing people tell stories. I hope it appeals to folks who are interested in a psychological view of things. I try to shed a little light on why people do farm, and there are more pieces in that last chapter that I read from that explain some of those, let's say, circumstances or factors that help make farm people do what they do. I'm working on this, as I said, this textbook on agricultural behavioral health, and one of the things I'm writing about there is what I call the agrarian imperative. It explains why people farm, because farming had survival value for the human species. It enabled us to transcend beyond being hunter-gatherers many thousands of years ago and to have a steadier food supply. Farming enabled us to be careful observers of the land and what we could do to help it produce more. So I've learned so much about what it is that moves or motivates people to engage in agriculture and how that has become embedded in our genetic structure. It has survival value and it has become encoded and into our human genome. So that's
now, Mike, are you still farming also?
Yes, I do farm some.
So you farm
on a limited basis. And I rent out the row crop plant.
Okay, so you farm and you teach and you have a clinical practice and you have this nonprofit organization. How do you find time to write a textbook and Excellent Joy? How are you fitting all that in?
As I said in the book, I had a little bit of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder as a child. I suppose I still have a little bit of that. I've had a lot of energy, and I have some wonderful God-given gifts. So,
well,
if I can do this, I think it's meant for me to do this, and I feel a need to do it because it's got to be done.
Well, I want to make the point that, I didn't expect to be all that interested in the fly fishing. but I found reading about it immensely satisfying.
Wonderful.
So you're right about it's literature, and it doesn't really matter whether the topic of good literature is something that you would be interested in doing yourself, although it actually made me want to go and try it. So
Okay. Well, I hope that's the case, too, because others need to experience the excellent joy that can come from that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, as you're talking, I was thinking about literary fishermen, and, of course, the one that pops to mind is Ernest Hemingway.
Yes.
And is that someone that you've admired for his writing ability?
Very much so. Dan O'Brien said, Mike, look up a couple of authors that appeal to you. And I have always liked Ernest Hemingway. He writes very directly and simply. He just states it. There it is, right out there in front of you. And I tried to emulate that, and that's maybe the best way I can operate, is just to say it simply, but directly, and to capture the feeling of it.
Well, you must have been successful, because that's who I thought about as we were having this discussion and thinking about your writing and what you had to say. So congratulations on that.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, we are out of time. So thank you so much for being with us.
It was a pleasure.
Mike Roseman with Excellent Joy, Fishing, Farming, Hunting, and Psychology, which is available at www.icecubepress.com, or you can order it from your local independent bookstore, if you're lucky enough to have one like we are.
Yeah.
And Mike, any last words?
Well, just to say thank you for hosting this wonderful show and asking me to be a guest on it.
It was our pleasure.
I so much appreciate that.
Well, thank you. And let us know when your next book comes out. We're looking forward to
I'll be certain to do that. Thanks.
Mom,
This is perfect. It's a little long, but it's perfect. If there is righteous...
I don't have any additional words, except that I hope if people find that something has moved them, that they will write me and let me know so that I can take my cues as to how this impacts other people.
Oh, very good. Thank you. Thank you so much.
If there is righteousness in the heart, there will be beauty in the character. If there is beauty in the character, there will be harmony in the home. If there is harmony in the home, there will be order in the nation. And if there is order in the nation, there will be peace in the world.
Thank you for listening to Writers' Voices, and see you next week. Stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.